Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. And Elizabeth, you seem a little distant.
I was wondering what would happen if I just didn't respond sometime when you said hello. So I wanted to see, you know, how you're doing in there.
Well, like I said, you're distant. You're much further away than you normally are.
I am. I'm sitting in the dark also,
which
might be a little off-putting to those of you who can't see me, or maybe not because you can't see me anyway.
Never can see you.
But it's kind of nice. I am sitting in the dark here. It's very relaxing. I'm kind of in a very relaxed and mellow and reflective mood today, which is, you know, probably a little different for me on Tuesdays. I usually come in pretty high energy and ready to go. But I am in kind of this waxing poetic kind of place. So I'm kind of setting the mood for that. How about you?
Oh, I wish I could say that I was relaxed, but we are in the midst of our pledge drive, and that's always a, I wouldn't say stressful, but it's like a whole, throws a bucket of water on my whole day. It's just, I don't dislike it. It's just, everything is different. You know, my whole job description changes for these 9 days. And so it's kind of a nice change of pace, but hectic would be the word.
You know, and it's funny, I really enjoy Pledge Drive because I like hearing everyone jump in throughout the day. It gives the station that great feeling of community and closeness and happening in the moment. So I can understand, though, if your life changes because you're engineering how all of it happens. But it is Pledge Drive this week, and so I'm always reminded during Pledge Drive of why I'm here and why the station's here and what we're trying to accomplish as a community service and being available and present in people's lives in such a way that it helps them, to feel more connected, more centered, part of something greater than themselves, all those wonderful things that we look for in maintaining our mental health. And so, you know, I appreciate Pledge Drive for what it is, the opportunity to support the station and to tell the station that you support what we're doing and the programs that we're offering. So just a reminder that you can pledge at any time during this hour. You can just go to the website, kcbx.org, and pledge your support for the show. And we appreciate your comments and any feedback. Love to hear from you because it's how we sustain the station. It's how we're able to provide the shows that you look forward to. And it gives me an opportunity to, you know, come in every Tuesday and share with you those things that are going on in my life and to find out those things that are going on in yours. So today I have kind of a collection of random thoughts that I hope are connected to one greater thought, but it has a lot to do with just the whole foundation of therapy and the idea of therapy itself, because we are here discussing mental health issues every week. I think it's important to remember why we talk about mental health every week and why sometimes I'm concerned about the state of our mental health. And at other times, I'm really excited about the ways that we're advancing the information, the ways that we help people. So today, I kind of want to explore some concerns about how we access therapy, how we access mental health services, and why some people don't access mental health services at all, and why do some people maybe overuse mental health services or overuse therapy as a tool or a crutch that can sometimes end up backfiring or not be as helpful as it should be. So that's kind of the overall theme that I have for today. And also to kind of give you an opportunity to open up and lead the discussion, the conversation where you want to go when it comes to kind of this general idea of mental health and mental health services. You know, we hear a lot about the stigma of seeking mental health services, and then that prevents people from actually going out and getting help in times of need. And that is an issue. But what's interesting, according to a recent APA poll, half of the people they surveyed, and I think they called 1,000 homes, half of the people they surveyed said that someone in their household had sought mental health services throughout the year or through that year. So that's a pretty good number. You know, we generally think that between 15 and 27% of all U.S. adults seek some sort of treatment each year. It doesn't seem like a high number, but it's I think, a better number than we imagine when we talk so much about the stigma of getting treatment and why people don't reach out and get treatment. So I think I'd like to know what your feelings are about this. You know, do you believe there's a stigma? Have you sought treatment in the last year? And would you even talk about it? You know, I was thinking today is kind of this opportunity to have therapists, not anonymous, but therapist. What would be the opposite of that? Therapist sharing. Because I think, you know, anonymity is one of the things that keeps us stuck. That when we suffer in silence, that when we keep our feelings and our struggles to ourselves, they get larger. They get magnified. That we start to feel less able to cope because we're now not only struggling with whatever mental health concern we have, we're now struggling to keep it a secret, right? We're struggling to make sure nobody finds out that we're in trouble or that we're not doing well. And so you kind of pile on these layers of heaviness, trying to cope, trying to go throughout your day, and then trying to hide from other people what's going on in your life. And it ends up being a counter issue. It doesn't help us. It makes us sicker. It makes things more difficult to deal with. So I'd like to have you share, if you're comfortable, your feelings about mental health and if you've struggled and how you dealt with it in the past. And if you're struggling with something now, it's kind of the good old fashioned, I'm here listening. So just share with me what's on your mind. 805-781-3875 is a number to be part of this conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can be part of the conversation on air with me. You can also check out our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. If you like us, you'll keep up with show topics as they come up each week and pictures or whatever else is going on. We also have our website, thereluctanttherapist.com, and you can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Joining the 21st century, we have our shows available on podcasts now, so you can go to iTunes and type in The Reluctant Therapist, and we should pop up. I think right now we pop up in two different ways, so we're trying to pull them all together into one, but better to have over coverage than under coverage. And you can subscribe to the show and have it downloaded to your devices, and then you can listen whenever you like or share it as you'd like. And you can also listen to previous shows by going to kcbx.org when you go to pledge, and then you can stream anything that we have. The difference is if you go to kcbx.org, you have to stream live. You have to have be connected to something, Wi-Fi, in order to hear it. If you go to iTunes, you can actually download it and then listen anytime. So that's probably the extent of my technological knowledge about how things work. So hopefully you'll be able to figure it out. All right, so today's topic, mental health in general, and I know it might feel a little broad and you're thinking, Ash, where do we jump in on this? But I have a couple places that I want to jump into. Because you know that I teach up at Cal Poly and I teach in the psych department, which makes sense. And so a couple of the classes that I'm teaching this quarter, one is basic counseling skills for the undergraduates, and it's kind of introducing them to just kind of the basic skills of listening and responding and hearing someone's story in a way that might help them process a mid-level concern, roommate issues, breakups, what do I do with the rest of my life, kind of those distress feelings that are common throughout the human experience that really are easier to cope with when we share them with someone else. That's a great use of talk therapy, is to be able to come in and hash out self-exploration issues such as what should I do for my life? What kind of career am I interested in? What do I do with this next part of my life now that my kids have grown and left home? Self-exploration is a great utilization of talk therapy. So in this class, we, you know, learn the tools of how to listen well and to respond briefly and to provide that space for someone to come in and share. And it's funny because the students always, you know, ask, I'm not doing anything. I'm just listening. Aren't I supposed to give advice, or am I supposed to just tell people what to do or help them live their lives better? I mean, I feel like I should be doing something and not just listening and holding the space, as I always say, or, you know, responding just to the words that they're using. But the trick is that by offering people this space, they can open up and explore their feelings and issues and concerns without someone interjecting their own thoughts and opinions about what should happen. And so, you know, my students kind of buy it, but they'll always question and say, well, if that's all we're doing is listening, then why don't people just go talk to their friends? Why don't we just tell our friends everything that's going on in our life? And why wouldn't that be the same as talk therapy? And that's a great question, because one of the great differences between the two has a lot to do with the conversation we had last week about Martin Buber and the stranger on the train phenomenon, and how when we talk to a stranger, they have no history of us, right? They don't have expectations or concerns or knowledge of who we were prior to this moment. They're just taking us for who we are as we present ourselves, as we tell our story. They're not vested in our well-being. They don't need us to be a certain way so that they're okay. That's the beauty of speaking to a stranger, is they just hear us for who we are in that moment. And that's why talk therapy is different than talking to a friend, because you also get to go into this non-judgmental space to talk to someone who's a stranger at the beginning about your life. And they too have no expectations of who you need to be or who you are. And they're able to just hear and reflect what's going on in your life. And then hopefully with their training, you know, beyond just the basics of lay therapy, but someone who has a license, that they have some life experience to offer, that they have some tools to help you deal with distress or anxiety or coping or grief. You know, they're specifically geared towards that. And then to give you, you know, an area or a space to talk about things that you may not feel safe talking about with your friends or your family, because it may make them feel differently about you. And how else do we get to know who we are, or to get a sense of how people or someone might receive who we are, if we don't get to bounce our ideas off another person? So that's my brief explanation of why therapy, talk therapy, psychotherapy is different than just talking to friends, and why it's important. In my other class that I'm teaching, it's a graduate level class, and it's for students that are going through the training to become marriage and family therapists to join me in my profession. So you can imagine how much I love teaching this class, because the reluctant therapist in me pops up all the time and wants to, you know, teach them these skills, but at the same time cautioning them for some of the ways, you know, that they need to be aware that things can go poorly in therapy, or that the modern model that we have right now isn't always working in the best interest of the clients that they're trying to serve. For example, yesterday we had an issue come up about diagnosis and how we recognize when children are struggling and what the common practice is right now in schools. And of course, I am very concerned, because we have a lot of lay people without the training in psychotherapy doing a lot of diagnosing of children, because they're seeing their behaviors in schools and then sending them to the doctor, and they're getting medicated primarily for ADHD symptoms. Most of the time children are diagnosed, you know, having never seen a clinician for any period of time, or never having their parents go in and see a clinician and see what's going on in the house. And so that's a big concern. And because we see also schools and, and school psychologists identifying children very early for very serious mental health concerns like ODD, which is oppositional defiant disorder. That's not a great disorder that you want to label a child with when they're young, because that sits with them in their folder, their record, all the way through school, and it changes the way teachers teach and address the child. It also sends them immediately off just the straight course of education and over into special ed. But that's a whole nother story, although I'm happy to talk about it if that's on your mind too. But when I was talking to my students about, you know, what the essence of therapy is and what draws people in, I guess like to remind them that therapy is a tool, and therapists are the keepers of the tools, I guess, in some way, where we might be the contractors of mental health. But therapy is a tool. And one of the things that's really important is that when clients come in or people seek therapy, that they understand that they need to be in many ways the driver of the process. That if you're seeking mental health support, that you need to have a clear idea of what it is you'd like to have happen in this process. It's very dangerous to go in and just kind of hand yourself over to someone and say, I'm broken, fix me. Because then you're just putting yourself out there for random tools to be applied to you. And you might not end up being in a place that, you intended to be. For example, if you're married and you're struggling, if you're in a relationship and you're needing help and you want to try to improve your communication skills, it's really important to understand, is our goal to be able to communicate better and to be able to keep this relationship together at the end of therapy? Or are we trying to figure out a way to break this relationship apart and go our separate ways? You know, what are our goals? What are our priorities? What are the commitments that we've made to each other? Because to just go into therapy and say, we don't get along, or we've fallen out of love, or we've stopped communicating, and we have no idea what to do, you're expecting the therapist to be able to read your mind or know your value system and to be able to guide you in a set course. But life has no set course. Everyone's life takes different twists and turns. We all have different values and belief systems. And so to just hand yourself over, your mental health and well-being, to another person, expect them to know how to fix you, is fairly irresponsible. Because we need to let the therapist know, here are our goals, here are our values, here are our belief systems. We'd like to have you help us get to this place. That's much more in keeping with good therapy than just going in and saying, hey, I'm yours, you know, tweak me as you like. And I think that's how we end up getting in dangerous situations with therapy, how we start to really compromise relationships that could have been healthy and get turned the other direction. We can't be complacent in our healthcare in any realm, whether it's mental health or physical health. So that's the start from me. Now I want to hear from you. 805-781-3875 is the number to join the conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I just am looking for your thoughts on this idea of mental health. Where do you fall in this? Do you feel that there's a stigma? Does it prevent you from reaching out? Have you had a positive experience with therapy? Do you wonder what kind of therapy would be best for you? Because that's the other part of the idea of the toolbox or therapy as a tool. There are many different types of clinicians, from psychiatrist to psychologist to marriage and family therapist to licensed clinical social worker. There are people that are practicing as life coaches now. I mean, there's a huge gamut of experience out there and different types of training that address different types of things. Many of you probably know that, you know, psychiatry requires an MD going to medical school. So just by nature of that training or that education, it's going to lean much more heavily on the medical model of diagnosing symptoms and treating those symptoms from a medical standpoint, usually with medication as one of the primary ways of intervening. If you're coming in for grief or wanting to improve communication skills or needing support or self-exploration, it might be that the heavy-handedness of a medical model is not going to be appropriate for that situation, because most of the mental health issues that we experience are transitory. You know, very few mental health issues are permanent or chronic or long-term. You know, that's probably 1 to 5% of the mental health issues, the mental health disorders. Most of us throughout our lifetime are going to experience mental health problems that are more transitory, referring to the presence of, you know, some signs or symptoms of feeling depressed or feeling anxious or struggling with grief or struggling with transitions in life, coping skills. You know, these are mental health problems that are really normal in the process of living life, and they usually require just a short-term or moderate course of talk therapy to kind of move out to the other side. But what's happened in our culture in the last 20 years is probably because of insurance, probably because of the heavy use of medications, probably because of the fear of being sued and the litigiousness of our culture. We tend to approach mental health with a much more heavy-handedness than we ever did in the past. We see the psyche from a much more biological space than more of an existential space, where the psyche is kind of more connected to our spiritual side than to our physical side. Although when we feel depressed or anxious or are struggling with attention or struggling with oppositional behaviors, they come out in physical symptoms. We see them in physical symptoms, which is why anxiety is so distressing and why depression is so distressing, because we feel those symptoms of a psychological problem in our physical body. And so it makes sense that we would immediately start to associate the physical sensation with being a biological problem, when in a lot of points in our life, we are feeling physical symptoms that are related mostly to something that's happening in the normal course of our life. All right. That's all I have to say. So I'm listening. What do you have to say? Where do you stand on this issue? Because in some ways, I think it's really, you know, it's not controversial, but maybe it is. But, you know, we have two schools here. One school of, you know, there's a stigma, and so people don't step out and get psychotherapy when they need it, or they don't reach out for treatment. You know, it's interesting, but some of the numbers suggest that half of those who have severe mental disorders, such as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or severe chronic depression or eating disorders, only half of those people, 47%, actually seek treatment. And if there was ever a part of our population that most needed and could benefit from treatment, it's the severely mentally, you know, those with mental health issues or illnesses that are severe and chronic, because there are medications, there are treatments, there are course of actions that can help alleviate a lot of those symptoms and help people to live better lives. The problem is, I think that's where the stigma lies, is that if we reach out for that kind of help, then we are labeled or targeted or fear losing our job or fear losing our family. And so people don't reach out and get help. But the other piece of it is that for some reason, or maybe not for some reason, but for the obvious reason, that people who are struggling the most with mental health issues, mental illness or mental disorders, are the least likely to reach out because they're so deeply in their mental health crisis that it makes them less apt to make that phone call or to access resources or to get the help that they need. You know, if you watch John Oliver's show Last Week Tonight, he did a great segment on the state of mental health in this country. I think it was last week or the week before. I don't know. Do you watch that, Jordan?
No, I don't have a TV.
Oh, that's right. You don't have the modern equipment that I do, like a television.
I'm a millennial, so I stream Netflix.
Oh, okay.
And I have my sister's HBO password.
I don't think you're supposed to say that out loud.
No, and I won't give it out.
Okay.
I do have it.
If you shared it, more people could watch. But I encourage you to watch. You know, John Oliver does a great job with these segments, but he did a great piece talking about how, you know, in an effort to improve the state of mental health in this country, John F. Kennedy, I want to make sure I'm telling it right now because I don't want to mix my facts, but I think JFK, you know, closed a lot of the asylums, which is where we housed people with severe mental illness for many, many years. And, you know, movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and documentaries, you know, showing the abysmal conditions of life in an asylum were everywhere at the time. And there was an outcry of, you know, we need to change what we're doing in treating people with mental health concerns. So he signed this order trying to shut down asylums, but in turn, they were going to open community mental health clinics so that you could walk in, right? So it was much more easy to access than trying to get into a doctor's office or a psychiatrist's office to get treatment and then end up in an asylum. But the idea of the mental health clinics, the community clinics, didn't really pan out to the level it should. So people weren't able to access the help that they needed. And to be honest, we really still to this day, and at that time even more so, didn't know exactly what to do with people with severe mental illness, right? We weren't really quite sure how to treat someone with schizophrenia or chronic depression or burn catatonic states, you know, serious mental illness. And so we weren't really sure what to do with the population of these people once we had mental health clinics in itself. But of course, as time went on and through the Ronald Reagan era, where they closed down the state mental hospitals, ours was Agnew State Mental Hospital up in the Bay Area, We just released people out into the streets with no help and no support. So you can imagine then that here we are 30 years later, how frightening it would be for anyone to step forward and say, I'm struggling with a mental illness, because the story we have of how we treat those with mental illness is not in their favor. It doesn't bode well. I mean, you're a millennial. So what is your idea of mental health and mental health services? When you think about mental illness, what is it you picture? What do you think?
Well, it's certainly not the cuckoo's nest movie, mm-hmm. which I've seen in psychology classes, among other films that depict how we treated mentally ill patients years and years ago, with like frontal lobotomies and mm-hmm. and mean nurses that mm-hmm. as depicted in a lot of the films. Because that seems old at this point, but how I view mental illness and treatment
would you seek treatment if you felt it was necessary, and who do you
well
think
okay
help?
So what one thing I was thinking about is, I think when you view it on a spectrum. Mm-hmm. Of like, okay, so I may be dealing with anxiety, but maybe I don't have a severe mental illness or a personality disorder or something like that. You know, I think a lot of people may be reticent because it's like, well, how badly do I need it? And what's the argument for getting mental treatment when you're dealing with something that is common in my age group or in America? You know, so that would be something I would be reticent to do, because I'm not sure, you know, how badly do I need it? Is that something I can work out on my own with my family or through reading and practicing, doing my own due diligence?
Well, and I think, you know, that's one of the dilemmas that we have, is how do we educate people about mental health and take away the fear that, you know, a lot of people believe that if they feel anxious, they're one step or one day away from being schizophrenic or having a psychotic break. Because if you've ever experienced a panic attack or any sort of anxiety disorder, you feel like you're one day away from a psychotic break. I mean, one of the symptoms of severe anxiety or panic anxiety is this sense that you're going insane, that you're out of control. And so, you know, I think that what prevents people from going in and getting treatment is that fear that they're going to end up in the asylum or they're going to end up on some heavy medication. And so I think that's where we have not done a great job in our profession of helping people understand that there is a continuum, right? There is a large array of different services for different types of concerns. And how do we get more people to access the help for low-level concerns to help the quality of their lives? Well, one of the ways we do that is to stop pathologizing, as a profession, normal life events. And we've talked about this. And I always love to know how you think, you know, feel about this also. You know, do you feel frightened by the mental health profession? Do you have concerns about seeking help for fear that they're going to over-prescribe or over-medicate or, you know, shrink your head, which is what a lot of people said when I went back to school, you're going to start shrinking brains. But we don't do that. That's not really what happens. But I think, you know, that fear prevents people. I don't know if the millennials really understand how it works. And we've medicated more people. We've medicated more young people than ever before in history. So I would imagine if I were a millennial, I'd be a little reticent about saying, hey, I'm struggling right now, for fear of ending up down the rabbit hole of prescribing medications. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation. And I know it's a little esoteric, but I really want to know, am I the only one that thinks about these things? Are you all just seeking therapy on a regular basis? Or are you frightened and feeling like we need to have therapy anonymous, that we shouldn't talk about those things that are struggles in our life, that we should keep them all secret and private? You know, I can respect that, but from a therapeutic standpoint, it's all those things that we keep secret and private that hurt us the most. And so I think it's important to have the courage to speak out loud about those things that we struggle with, whatever those things are, from grief to disappointment to anxiety and depression. 805-781-3875. Dr. Schwartz, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Thanks. Was driving back from the hospital, heard a little bit of your discussion about some of the changes in access to mental health. And I wanted to clarify a couple things that I think might help us understand where we're at. And
great.
You were mentioning Kennedy and the Community Mental Health Act. And, you know, Kennedy was not really looking at closing institutions. It was really about creating mental health access in the community. And it was a pilot program. And after that, that just no longer was federally funded. And, you know, communities that kept them going and states that kept them going didn't have the federal resources after that first few years. The closure of the long-term psychiatric hospitals reflected two big waves. One was a post-war wave where the, you know, bad conditions were highlighted in Life magazine and such, and fiscal conservatives didn't want to pay for what really were, you know, big expensive programs. And so, you know, the kind of liberal libertarian movement and the fiscal conservative movement made a deal and started closing things. And the final blow really had to do with the fact that early on, when Medicaid and Medicare were established to provide federal funding for people who were disabled, the long-term psychiatry was excluded from that funding. So monies that might have gone to sustaining or building programs in long-term institutions never appeared. And so, you know, it's easier to break things than to build them. And here we are 50 years later, you know, trying to figure out how to meet the needs that have been ever present. So, you know, it's a work in progress.
So, Dr. Schwartzen, what's the state of our mental health in this county? Because, you know, I hear more often than not that people end up, you know, in a hold, right, or a three-day hold, and then they're off because there isn't any place to place them or there isn't any services.
Well, you might want to look into, you know, kind of how the county organizes resources. You know, the 3-day hold for a mental health evaluation is really a, you know, something that is, you know, the only county designated to put people on holds or take them off of holds in this county. That varies county by county in the state. The lack of inpatient acute psychiatric resources is statewide. We've lost over half the beds that we had 10 or 15 years ago, and it isn't like the population has remained stable.
Right.
So other than a very small, local, acute, rapid turnover, county-funded inpatient unit here, everything else is far away and pretty much full. Mm-hmm. So, you know, getting, there is some access to acute mental health care, you know, for people who don't need to be on holds, but they really have to travel to get that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have to go to Stanford or go to Santa Barbara or Ventura or L.A., you know, which is a, you know, it's terribly inconvenient. And, you know, but rebuilding comprehensive, coordinated, you know, seamless inpatient to outpatient, you know, for goodness sakes, you know, day hospital programs, you know, used to be very helpful, both in an acute and chronic treatment situation. Building that kind of array of resources is not easy. You can't just, you know, turn those kind of programs on and off like a light switch.
And as you said, it's not as if the population is stabilized or dropped. The need is great and always there, correct?
Yeah, correct.
All right, so Dr. Schwartz, because I always, you know, take my digs at psychiatry, tell me some of the good news about what's going on in the field of psychiatry, because I've read some recent...
I haven't heard any digs.
Okay, good.
The news is...
Well, because I've read some research that said the Psychiatric Association is starting to recognize the need for more talk therapy and less medications. And are you feeling that shift a little bit?
Well, look, the pendulum swings back and forth in terms of, you know, everything has its, you know, its day in a fad sort of a way. Now, maybe you're referring to the news in the last day or two about a large study really looking at and randomizing the use of more, you know, interpersonal, supportive, direct kind of counseling in first-break schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, clinicians have always known this. You know, in a sense, it's not news, but it's always good to have data that if you really can engage people the first break, which is not always easy to do. Mm-hmm. But if you can engage people, and you know, you don't need to medicate them as heavily. They don't have to be without any symptoms. They have to learn how to function with their illness. But again, those are, you know, are labor intensive, and you know, you that really need fairly well trained people to do that. So,
but that is good news, though, because I think any time that we talk about giving people the opportunity to learn to deal with their issues instead of giving them the idea that they're ever going to be symptom free is a shift in our mindset, right? But I think people think if I go in for therapy, I'll get healed and never feel this way, when those of us who are in the profession say, no, we'll help you cope with the way you're probably going to feel, right?
Yeah. Well, help you understand what you go through, to know when it's, you know, when you're really getting in trouble, to, you know, to try to avoid you know, the more severe breakdowns. And some, you know, like with any illness, you know, it takes a process of any chronic illness of, you know, learning to manage your condition.
And then my last thing, and I'm sorry I'm taking all your time, but I'm so excited that you called. So what I also talk a lot about is that we have to understand that this, the continuum of mental health, that on one end we have schizophrenia and schizophrenic breaks, but on the other end we're talking about coping with grief and transition and loss and sadness, that talk therapy still is really, I hope you'll agree, one of the primary ways of helping people cope with those normal day-to-day experiences, and that they don't necessarily need to be medicated.
People are resilient, and they get through a lot, and they get through it sometimes with therapy and sometimes with, you know, really more informal support systems. And, you know, it's hard to know when you're going to really get your boat rocked by life.
But, so true.
The continuum, you know, I'm not quite sure what I want to say about your comments about the continuum of troubles, but look, there, you know, we are both, you know, biological creatures and, you know, and psychological creatures, and, you know, and you can get undermined from either direction. You know, finding some kind of balance, you know, look, there's good therapy, and I've certainly seen very destructive therapy too. And people have to, you know, take responsibility for monitoring, you know, how they feel their therapy goes, you know, rather than putting everything, you know, it's a collaboration with the therapist. So
absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Schwartz, for taking
the
time to call.
Take care.
Enjoy your day. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. The number to be part of our conversation is 805-781-3875. And I started the show off the top of the hour talking about, you know, wanting to help educate the population about therapy and how we can take charge of our therapeutic experience so that we make sure that we are the drivers of our healing and not just handing our mental health and well-being over to others. So what do you think about this? Is there something that prevents you from seeking therapy, or have you had good experiences before? What are your thoughts about mental health in general? 805-781-3875. Paulette, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call. It's very emotional for me.
I'm sorry. I can hear it in your voice.
What I want to know is why, when children are put in Child Protective takes them and put them in foster homes, why are they drugged? I know of a little child, it started when he was 3 years old, he is now four. That child gets drugged because the foster parent can't deal with, the poor little guy doesn't know how to act. Why are they putting them on drugs? And some of the people around him are not, quote, professionals, they're volunteers, and they make the diagnosis. I don't understand. The mother did this. She's a druggie and has a long history of that. The father is a good father, and he wants the child. Child Protective is trying to block the father from getting the child. And the poor child, what about the child?
No, Paula, I can hear how emotional you are about this. And, you know, it's a really tough conversation to have, because we're not inside of Child Protective Services, and we don't know what their protocol is or how they make these decisions. I don't know who the child's seeing. You know, there's so many variables in this situation. But I think one of the things that it can address is that we do statistically, unfortunately, medicate children from lower socioeconomic backgrounds and children in the foster care system than we do children in the kind of general population. So,
yes, I know this. How sad. How sad.
It is sad because they can't speak for themselves. And once we start them down
that path, goes with them throughout their life through school. And like you said earlier, it changes how they get treated throughout their life. This poor little boy is trying so hard, and he has reactions to the drugs, gets rashes, and they don't see that. They just want to drug him more. The father is fighting so hard to get this child through the courts. And Child Protective is the ones that are pushing for the mother to have this child.
Oh, and Paul, I'm sorry. What I was going to say is I think this is a conversation that's deeper than I'm qualified to go, because I can't speak for CPS. I just want you to know that I hear the concern in your voice, and it's something that I share with you, because we do see an out of balance number of people who have less access to resources, less access to education, less access to financial help, tend to get medicated at higher rates. Now, just stepping away and looking at it from the outside, one of the other concerns is if parents don't have the tools to properly parent or guide their children or help them learn, you know, how to behave, how to be in class, I can understand how it would start to seem easier to kind of medicate these kids into compliance than it would be to have to do the hard work. And Dr. Schwartz even mentioned that you know, no work with mental health is quick and easy. If it's a behavior concern or a chronic health concern, it takes a long time to help children and adults to process what's going on in their life and get to the other side. So unfortunately, I think at this moment in time, because medications are available, and because it is how the protocol for treatment is written, that we're not going to see a lot of change anytime soon for children. And that is heartbreaking because it is life changing. And again, I wonder what it has to do with, you know, the idea of the stigma of reaching out and getting mental health treatment. You know, I hate to think that people don't go out and find a therapist or someone to talk to when they're dealing with things like distress and loss and parenting issues. You know, a good therapist is a great resource for parenting help, to talk about, you know, your history as a child. You know, what? And I'm going to back up. And Paulette, thank you for taking the time to call. But one of the things that I don't know if the general population understands, and sometimes I take for granted that I spent 20-something years in this world, but when we look at parenting children, one of the real struggles is that we don't have one book that says, here's how you parent your child. Although each generation feels like they have their book, right? That their way of dealing with children and how to best raise children. And you know that we go back and forth and the pendulum swings in parenting. But we don't have one book. The other thing about parenting is that we're heavily influenced by the way we were parented ourselves. That pattern of parenting we take with us into raising our children. So if you were raised by parents who were loving and present and capable, you tend to have a better chance of being a loving and capable and present parent yourself. We learn those skills from the people we were parented by. But if you did not have access to really solid parenting, how do you learn those skills, right? How do you know how to best guide your children and help them to manage what's going on in their lives or to grow and develop in healthy ways? Well, for many people, if they feel they had terrible parenting, they tend to want to do the opposite, right? I'll just do everything my parents did not, and then I'll be a better parent. But unfortunately, that really is never enough, because just rejecting everything you saw still doesn't give you a plan for how you are going to behave as a parent. How are you going to set boundaries? How are you going to set limits? How are you going to know what's developmentally appropriate for that child at that age? These are skills that we still have to learn. We can't just gut react and parent. Parenting is pretty complex, and it takes some sort of guidance and training. Again, in the olden days, we had our grandmothers and our wise elders who kind of passed on the traditions of parenting. But now we're, you know, searching all over the place to try to get parenting information. The biggest mistake we make is getting our parenting information from someone who has kids that are under the age of 30, because you don't really know how you've done as a parent until your kids are adults themselves. So that's the struggle with helping children in schools, because if we don't have access to the parents and help them relearn to parent or to gain parenting skills, it's very difficult to help children succeed in school. So that was a long way of getting to that answer, that we really need to figure out a way to help access parents who need training in offering the best to their children. Because no one ever becomes a parent with the intention of hurting their child. No one does. But if we don't have the skills, then we're just making it up as we go. We have a higher risk of repeating the same mistakes with our children that happened with us. 805-781-3875. If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. Bonnie, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Well, I just enjoyed what you discussed with the last call-in. But what I wanted to address was the alternatives to talk therapy and medication. I have lived experience with bipolar, including a psychotic break and attempted suicide. And the thing that, besides finding an appropriate therapist, which is monumental, because if you have insurance, they give you a list, and it's kind of overwhelming to start making calls and not really having an idea of who you're going to get and what they're like. And it may take some time to see if you actually match.
Absolutely.
But the other things that I wanted to mention that I've done I've been incredibly well, considering how really sick I was. Mm-hmm. The doctor was getting to the point where we didn't know what medication to try next. That in itself is so overwhelming. But the things that I've done that are very helpful is that I have a meditation practice, which involves journaling, and I have a Buddhist teacher. And so it's a very gentle approach in looking at yourself and looking at conditions, past conditions and the causes, and realizing that those things are stories. They happened in the past. They're not here. It's not in the present moment. It's a process. I've been doing this for, 7-8 years. Mm. And I really feel that working with a teacher, a Buddhist teacher, and also I'm in a cohort group, that has been key. The other things that I used was reading poetry. When I was in first recovery, I would read this one poem. It was a nature poem. And I would go on nature walks and just take time to look at trees and just look and see what's there and be grateful for it. The other thing was aromatherapy, picking a little bit of lavender or rosemary and just smelling it, taking the time to just breathe it in and let it kind of cleanse me and my mind. And those things were very helpful. The other thing is exercise. I like to swim. And exercise, they told me at UCLA, is like taking an antidepressant. If you swim 40 minutes a day or some type of exercise. Let's see. The other thing that I have done in these recent years is I've joined a team over at Through Transitions. It's called the Peer Advisory Advocacy Team, and they're people with lived experiences of all kinds, and we accept each other, and we support each other. We get involved with committees. I'm on the County Cultural Competency Committee. I've attended the Mental Health Services Act committee meetings. I was sent to a conference on stigma in San Francisco a year ago. So it's given me, and I was a nurse. I was a nurse practitioner. So it's given me that sense of being of purpose.
You know, and Bonnie, I really appreciate you calling in. One, because I had asked at the beginning of the show, if we could talk about these things that we struggle with, it helps so many other people who are actually struggling. So you just taking the time to call, I think, helped a lot more people than you'll ever imagine. And also the fact that you're you're modeling the importance of taking charge of our mental health, taking charge of our well-being, taking charge of our therapy, and doing the work. Because I think a lot of people go into therapy and are very passive. They want to be done to, right? They want to be fixed. They just want to give me the medication and fix me. And what you're talking about is how active we have to be in our recovery and in our health, that we have to get up and go exercise, even on the days that we can't imagine wanting to do it. We have to eat right, and yeah. working with the mm-hmm. Buddhist teacher is, you know, are all really important and powerful things. And so I just want to thank you for sharing that. And also I want to wish you well in your continued recovery. And also 7 to 8 years, that's an incredible amount of discipline to stay with it. So thank you for taking the time
you.
To call in.
Sure.
Enjoy your
thank
day.
You.
Enjoy good health. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Suzanne, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to call regarding a library book I happened to pick up last week and I found incredibly interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The name of it is Saving Normal.
I have the book.
You have the book.
I have read it.
I'm enjoying it so much that I thought I would mention it to other people. I don't know if you've talked about it on your show before.
I don't know if I have, so thank you for reminding me.
Okay, so Saving Normal is authored by Alan Francis, MD, and he was the chair of the DSM-4 task force, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he really goes into in that book how we got to the place we are right now, where people are substituting medication, and really the whole saving normal of realizing the fluctuations that we have are something that is normal, and that we are resilient, as Dr. Short said before.
Yes.
But that we are resilient people, in that when we make so many things out as abnormal that are just the normal fluctuations. I also just wanted to say that, you know, in my own life, I have felt each time that there has been a shift, time to retire, time to a lot big losses in my life, I've gone to talk therapy, and I've found it very helpful and something that could just help me make those transitions and more smoothly, and help me maybe gain some tips that would help the rest of the next phase of my life. And that's about it.
Thank you so much, Suzanne. And it is true that most of the things that we experience, 90% of the experiences we're going to have in our mental health are going to be transitory, that we are going to live through them. It may be painful. It may be overwhelming. We may need someone to kind of hold us in that space for a period of time, but we will get through to the other side. And my concern, as always, for the 7 years I've been doing this show, is that as a profession, we jump in much too quickly and try to intervene with medications, because we've been taught that we're not as resilient as we think we are, that we don't have the ability to overcome serious and painful and overwhelming, devastating situations without some sort of medical intervention. So I think that's the dance that I kind of continue doing, is I don't want to stigmatize or to diminish the importance of medication for those who cannot function in their life without it, with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. But I also want to make sure people understand that we have to be the drivers of our health, that we have to do the work. We have to exercise, eat right, as I said before, and to understand that we do, every one of us, are much stronger than we think we are. So, Suzanne, thank you for the reminder about Saving Normal, because it is a great and fascinating read.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling in. And our last call today, Jan, you get the last two questions.
Oh, great. Thank you. Well, one's a comment and the other is a question.
Okay.
So comment is, if we were to educate our therapeutic community that there's a genetic propensity or a genetic component to all mental illnesses, and that takes the stigma of it being, a disorder versus a disease. And I think more people would reach out and get therapy if they had the comfort to know that their therapist had a sense of... an ability to communicate that. And then the second thing was, what are your thoughts on going to a therapist that, say, has experienced the same type of disorder or anxiety that you're going through? I'll give you an example. Let's say you lost your job, and you're going to a therapist to get some help with that. Well, that person lost their job, too, but, they manned it up. And would they have more or less empathy for you? I'll take my answer off here.
Thanks for calling in, Jan. And it's interesting because I was just reading an article before the show about one of the myths of therapy is that you have to go to a therapist who's had a similar experience. Otherwise, it's not going to be so helpful. And the response was, you know, therapists are trained to be able to sit with any story, but, you know, they should be capable of being able to guide and listen and offer support because we're not giving advice, hopefully. A good therapist is not giving advice because we don't know what's best for every person. We can only offer tools and you know, psychoeducation, whatever is helpful. But having said that, I have to say that my bias is that if I were going to see a therapist, when I go to see a therapist, I want it to be someone who is aligned with my values, who's aligned with my goals in life, you know, who has had similar experiences or similar commitments, because I think it's very difficult to help to guide someone or to sit with someone or to be genuinely with someone their experience if you don't share a similar worldview. You know, I think it really is important to, that's why we talk about when it goes to going to seek therapy. It's so great to have the time to interview and talk to different therapists because we are all very different. We have different personalities. We have different strengths. We have different areas of training. Just because we have a license doesn't mean we're able to really cover all sorts of mental health concerns well. You know, we get special certifications or we go to different workshops to get better training. And I also, to be honest, would go to the oldest therapist I can because they've been down the road. There's something beautiful about wisdom that really is invaluable. Life experiences are invaluable. And so to wrap things up today, as always, I so appreciate everyone who takes the time to call and share their story. I appreciate my listeners. I appreciate your support. Please take the time during Pledge Drive to go online, kcbx.org, and pledge your support for the show so we know that you want us to hang around here. And I'm going to leave you today with a little Doobie Brothers, little Michael McDonald, because some days I just need to have it, and the song Minute by Minute, because really, ultimately in life, sometimes we're just getting by minute by minute, and we get by with a little help with our friends, which is a different song, but we get by because we look after each other. So I look forward to speaking to you again next week, and thank you for supporting Public Radio, KCBX. I keep holding on.